Hey, what's up, guys? It's your host, Lopez, and I just want to say thank you for tuning into this episode today. If you're on Facebook and want to show some support with a like on the page, you can find it by going to facebook.com/behindcloseddoorspodcast or just searching Behind Closed Doors Podcast. You can also find it on Twitter at the BCD Podcast and on Instagram at the Behind Closed Doors Podcast. Last but not least, follow the podcast on Spotify by searching Behind Closed Doors in the podcast section to see all the amazing upcoming interviews I have to come. Every Sunday, I post a picture of a band with a hint of who my next guest is. Then on Tuesday, I post a brief clip from our video interview with a good highlight of our conversation we had. And lastly, post the new episode up on Spotify every Thursday morning. Now, on to the episode. Got Craig Bartok from the band Heart. How are you doing today, Craig?
I'm well, thank you. Life is good here in Northern California, so I'm doing well.
That's good to hear, brother. That is good to hear. What part of California are you from?
I'm just south of the wine country. I'm north of San Francisco.
Okay. Is that where you've lived your whole life then? Or?
No, I grew up in San Diego, then moved to L.A. like every other person in the entertainment business and lived there for a number of years. And then when it got to the point where with music, where people seemed to have recording studios in their houses and everybody was able to sort of do things remotely. I just thought, why am I in Los Angeles when I don't really like the city that much? So I moved up north and I've never regretted it since. And you know, so by putting my time in LA though, as most people in the business do.
What's the weather like over that way?
Today's going to be probably low 70s.
Low 70s. Holy cow. How about that?
I know. It's like, I felt bad. It's like when Texas was getting hammered, it's like we were like having some crazy heat wave. It was like close to 80. And it's like, oh man, if I could just FedEx some of that heat over to them.
I'm in northern Indiana, and it's, I'm looking now, it is a high of 41 today. That's actually not that bad for what it's been over this way. Usually it's around this time of year. We've gotten this the mildest winter all year so far. So it's usually about like in the 15 to like 20. And in January, we got really lucky. The lowest it got was like 10 below, but usually it's like 20, 30 below, and it's pretty freezing, pretty bitter cold.
Where in northern Indiana are you?
I'm in a town called Wanata, right outside of the Michigan and Illinois border. So, okay. I was born in a town called Michigan City, Indiana. Casino there, and Four Winds is not that far off from it.
Yeah, I was born in East Chicago, Indiana.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So over by like Hammond and Gary, that.
Yeah, like Hammond in that area. You know, I don't remember it because my parents moved to San Diego when I was three.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, I've been back to that area numerous times, you know, on tour. And, you know, it's interesting. I saw like, you know, the area where I lived before I knew anything, you know, like it when I was two and all that. So, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
I used to deliver medical equipment to hospitals and whatnot. So if you were born in, you said East Chicago?
Yeah.
I probably delivered to the hospital that you were born in.
Yeah, if it's still there.
That is crazy. Yeah. That is crazy. So you played guitar. What got you into playing guitar?
Well, actually, you know, I've really I started at a very early age. It's like when I was a really little kid, I just really wanted to play guitar. As a matter of fact, I would take, like, you know, I was like 6 years old. I would take my mom and dad had one of those traditional fireplace sets with the little poker and the shovel and a brush. And I used to take the little shovel and like take our dog's leash and put it across it like a string and pretend like it was a guitar when I was like really, really, really little. So when I was eight, for my birthday, I got a beginner's guitar and sort of taught myself how to play and I started my first band and was doing my first gigs when I was like 12. Like, you know, we played it like the seventh grade talent show in the eighth grade, you know, and by the time I was in eighth grade, I had already started a band that was like playing in San Diego, like doing like dances and, you know, those type of things. Any place that would like, I can remember that, you know, we had a manager as well, and he was a school teacher. And he would say, well, you guys can't play, you know, you're not old enough to play high school dances and that sort of thing yet, because you're, you know, nobody's going to take, you know, 13 year olds that seriously right. when you're like 17. Ooh. So, yeah. So by the time we got, you know, a little older, we were like playing like consistently throughout San Diego. And, you know, back in those days, San Diego was a great place to be a musician because of the close proximity to, all the Navy bases and Camp Pendleton, the Marine base. So every one of those places, like there was probably, I don't know, 10 at least Navy bases in San Diego, and everyone had an enlisted men's club and an officer's club, and they would have live bands. So there was never shortages of places to play, you know. So we were actually like working musicians when we were kids. I bought my first car when I was 16, and was a Camaro, and I bought it, you know, cash with the money that I had actually earned, you know, from working. That's, it's pretty wild. It's,
yeah,
some kids had paper routes, and I was packing up a guitar and an amplifier in a step van and going to play in Navy bases.
Yeah, I was talking with Kenny Lewis yesterday from Steve Miller Band, and he was saying that he had a paper route, so that's funny.
Yeah. It's, oh, you know, it's, well, we all have to do what we have to do to make that little extra money, you know, back in those days. And
now, what kind of music did you find yourself playing to, like, what influenced you to keep progressing with the guitar?
Well, you know, I really, you know, I was like a real big, like, you know, I sort of came out of the British invasion thing. So obviously the, you know, the Beatles and every British band that followed after that. And, you know, then getting into, you know, sort of heavier stuff like Deep Purple and these type of things, Jethro Tull, all that type of thing. But, you know, quickly on, like by the time I was probably 16 or 17, I decided really that guitar playing really wasn't like the thing that I really wanted to focus on. So the guitar playing turned out to be, you know, a stepping stone into really writing and producing and spending all my time in studios. And so I didn't really like sit there and just go over scales and, you know, and do all that. To me, guitar playing was a way ultimately to express myself with my songwriting, which is ultimately how I got to be, you know, involved with Heart, because for years and years and years before Heart, I had a production company and I was a songwriter, music producer. And the only time I really picked up the guitar for many, many years is when I, you know, when I had was playing it on a song I was working on, or you know, an artist I was developing or producing or something like that, you know, then I'll grab the guitar. But I, you know, for me, it was like, this is how I write a song. And so, it was kind of the impetus to sort of like, you know, the stepping stones to get into a situation with Heart. I mean, previous to Heart, I had a very successful production company in Los Angeles, and I had just finished doing a song with Debbie Harry and Blondie, and which was currently out at the time. And I was also partnered with Nikki Six and another very amazing keyboard player named Jeff Bova. The three of us had a production company, and we were producing people, and I was working with Yes and Chris Squire, and we were writing stuff for Meatloaf, and I mean, it goes on and on and on, you know. So Heart was just another sort of, I believe they call them legacy acts, that I was, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I was managed by the same, I'm sort of probably getting ahead of our interview.
No, you're totally cool.
You know, I was, as a producer songwriter, I had a management company that was also managing Heart at the time, and they saw that I could speak the same language as people, you know, from that did a lot of music from the 70s and 80s. And I grew up with the same influences as Anna and Nancy. I mean, obviously huge Beatle fans, but they were also big Yes fans and Led Zeppelin fans, obviously. So, I mean, it was an easy transition to, like, when I got the call and said, you know, well, Heart's going to go in and they're going to do their first studio album in 13 years and they haven't really recorded anything, and they kind of would like somebody to just kind of, you know, kind of work with and you know, kind of bounce ideas off of. And then Nancy came to my studio in LA, and we became fast friends and wrote a number of songs just in one day. And it was a really great collaboration. You know, they're very, very, Ann and Nancy are very, you know, they're wonderful people. And and, you know, and the bottom line is I was demoing songs for them. You know, they happened to be on the road at the time. This was like 2002. So it was close to 20 years ago. And they were touring, and I was in the studio, and I would demo up little song ideas, and I would send the MP3s, via email to Nancy, wherever she happened to currently be. You know, and like, it's like, oh, that's great. You know, when I get back, we'll work on this, we'll work on this, we'll work on that. And, we got to the point where we ended up producing and writing the album together. And it was an album called Jupiter Starling that came out in 2003, I think. And, and I played a lot of the guitars on the album. It was like one of those things where it's like, well, you know, here, Nancy, you want to play this acoustic guitar part? Well, you already know it. Just go ahead and go out there and play it. So I just, you know, or we just would use like a track from the demo. So, one day, you know, we're sitting around in the studio, and Nancy just kind of just said, Mike McCready, who's in Pearl Jam, she goes, I ran into Mike at the airport, and, you know, and what he said to me, he goes, you know, well, Craig really should be your guitar player. And I just was like kind of floored, because I just said, I was just kind of didn't say anything. Like, did she just ask me to become a member of Heart? Because she didn't say, do you want to play? You know, it's like, it wasn't like this thing where it's like, I got this letter saying you want to be, you know? And so I just kind of sat there like in a quandary the entire day, just thinking, well, I don't know what she's asking. And so as it turned out, you know, I did, you know, they did ask me, and I really did love the people involved and the crew, and everybody was just so nice and wonderful that it's just, it just made sense for me to do it, because I could continue to do whatever else I did, develop my own music as an artist, develop other people and do that. And so it was kind of the best of both worlds. And I hadn't toured up until that point. I had been on a tour bus. I didn't have the proper equipment. You know, I mean, I had lots of guitars and amplifiers, but having things for being on tour is significantly different. I mean, you have to have roadworthy amps and guitars that are going to hold up and they're not going to break.
Right.
So, I had to, you know, with the help of a very, really great guitar tech named Jason Stockwell, who kind of took me under his wing, who was a real pro, and just said, okay, you know, like, here's kind of, you know, let's get this amp, let's, you know, like, you like Vox amplifiers, you know, let's get this amplifier, let's get that. And, you know, he's the one who devised my pedal board for me, and kind of really, really just like helped me make the transition from spending all my time in studios and writing and producing to actually stepping on the stage with them, which is a completely different world.
Now, what year was all this that you joined in with them?
2002 to 2003.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So next thing I want to cover is just a couple of the songs that some of them are before you joined with them, and then some are going to be with your guitar on the actual tracks. So the first one, right. I don't know if you're a Spotify or an iTunes guy.
Yeah, well, I'm more of an iTunes guy.
iTunes, okay. So on Spotify, the song Alone is the number one played song in Hearts category, which is at 181 million streams currently. What, in your opinion, makes that song stick out?
Well, you know, one of the things that's made it to be really, 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 I think, played a lot is the fact that the song's been covered a number of times. Mm-hmm. I think Carrie Underwood did it, like that she won American Idol when she sang Alone. And Anne's got one of these voices, and I've seen some of the most famous, greatest singers be intimidated by Anne, just and only just because, you know, Anne's reputation for being a stellar singer, you know, always precedes her. Anne happens to be one of the most soft-spoken, sweetest people you'd ever want to meet. But I think the fact that the song has been covered so many times, because people, it's like, if I can sing like Ann Wilson, I can prove that I can sing. Mm-hmm. So, and the song is the right combination of being just a sort of a pop, sort of an 80s rock ballad, and it can be interpreted in a number of ways. It's not a complicated song. It's got the same, if you look at, like, there's a video on YouTube, it's a group called Axis of Awesome, and they have How to Write a Hit Song in Four Chords, you know, and it's the same four chords, you know, and those four chords are in Alone as well, you know, so it's a very formulaic song, but it also, I think it's a very simplistic song with the message, and I think people can relate to that, and due to the fact that it's been covered by so many people, also, so it's like, you know, well, I've heard this person do it, I wonder what the original sounds
exactly
like.
So, yep,
that type of thing.
Yeah, and that's how I do it too, you know. I hear a song, and believe it or not, like with Love Hurts by Nazareth, had no idea that that was even a cover, and then I'm like, well, now I got to hear the original, you know.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny, you go years and years and years, and like, you realize that some of these songs that become big hits, it's like, and still to this day, I'll hear a song, and then, like, I'll be listening to something on Sirius XM, and it's like, here's the original version of that song from 1962. And right. It's like, you know, it was some obscure song on an album, and somebody, you know, plucked it off it became a big hit.
That's what a lot of people, how they feel about with Turn the Page with Metallica. A lot of people are like, that's a great song. And I always tell them, you know, have you ever heard Bob Seger, the actual original? They're like,
right.
Bob Seger, who's that? You know, and like, that's right. The guy that they, you know, Metallica covered his song, and they hear that and they're like, oh my God, like, that's insane.
Oh yeah, it is.
Now the next song is the highly played, it's the number one most played song on Spotify, sitting at 223 million streams. It was just recently used in the Trolls World Tour movie. Is the song Barracuda. That song has been used in different numerous movies and a bunch of different.
Boy, it sure has.
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of people. You know, it's been on Guitar Hero. It's just a really popular song. Now with that song, when you were hearing that song for the first time, did you ever imagine that you'd be playing it live with Ann and Nancy?
No, not at all. And it's like, you know, that truly is one of the great classic, you know, classic rock songs of all time. You know, and Ann and Nancy were influenced by a lot of other people too. I think there's, Nancy has said in numerous interviews that sort of chunking guitar came from some other band that they were, you know, that they were listening to. So, you know, it's funny because, you know, as an artist, you listen to these songs, you listen to songs, and then you think that you might be accidentally ripping them off, but just your own spin on it makes it be so unique that it's not the case. You know, Barracuda is probably one of the, you know, what, like I said earlier, when I got to know Ann and Nancy, it was like, you know, it was just Nancy just coming over to my studio, you know, just kind of like, you know, she wasn't, you know, she was just like, just a civilian, you know, and Ann as well. So I got to know them as people, and we spent a lot of time together, and we used to, like, you know, the three of us would have these long, they call them hootenannies, where we would sit around and we would just play Neil Young and Beatles songs for hours. You know, we'd play like just, oh, you know, Nancy would start playing a song, then we'd play it. And then we'd have our friends like Rick Nielsen would join from Cheap Trick would join in and all these people. But getting back to Barracuda, I remembered very distinctly, like early on, playing that song, and I was on stage, and we wear the in-ear monitors, you know, like the professional, you know, the molded ones, and so you can hear everything very clear, and I could hear Ann's voice very clearly, and so I'm used to being in the studio with Ann or like rehearsals, and I remember being on stage early on, and we're playing Barracuda, and for some reason I just had this bizarre out-of-body experience. I thought, wait a minute, that's Ann Wilson. You know, it's like, you know, it's like singing Barracuda, like, you know, six feet from me, and I'm playing Barracuda and she's singing it. And it was like, this is really bizarre, because it's like, I went from being, you know, in the band to being, you know, a spectator in the audience for a minute. You know, and then I regained myself and started thinking, well, I got to do my laundry tomorrow and wonder what the hotel room's going to be like in the morning. And, you know, I came back to reality.
Give me just 1 second. Me, for whatever reason. Yeah, I can. For me, I play drums. So like I said, yesterday, I interviewed Kenny Lee Lewis from Steve Miller Band, and I have a couple different people lined up. Like tomorrow I have, why can't I think of it? Alan Gratzer from REO Speedwagon, and just stuff, you know, older bands like that. And I'm in my 20s, so it's very, very kind of rare, I guess, for people my age to be into bands like Heart, you know, and REO Speedwagon and Black Sabbath and Foreigner, Boss, and all those good, you know, those classic, true original classic rock bands. And for me, if I was ever to just let alone be able to hang out backstage with them, let alone play a show with them, that'd just be a dream come true, honestly.
Well, you know, it's interesting. All those bands you mentioned, we've all crossed paths and are friends and have played at various times at shows together, and you know, and have toured. And it is an interesting group of people, because I got to say that everybody in the bands you've mentioned are really, really nice. I mean, you know, people, you know, it's like, I think when you get to the point where you're at a certain age, I mean, obviously the same things that have drove you to be in a band when you were younger, you know, have changed, mm-hmm. You know, so we do look at it like a real job, in the sense that, you know, there's really no drugs. There's no craziness. It's like, you know, we stay healthy. We, you know, we're good friends with each other. You know, we look out for each other. You know, the band members are all really good friends. And, you know, like I said, like, you know, like we tour a lot with Joan Jett and Cheap Trick and a lot of these bands over the years, and they've become good friends. And you start to realize what really great people they are, you know, because you go through your 20s and maybe your 30s, and you have kind of a crazy period where maybe you've done a little too much of one thing or something like that. And then eventually you come out the other side and you just go, okay, I see what it's all about. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's just all about it's about entertaining people, but it's also about friendships and being nice to people and being kind to people. And you kind of, you know, hopefully you get to that point, because if you don't, you know, you're going to be, you're going to, what's the point of it? You know, what's the point of, like, you know, being, having success and being miserable at the same time? I mean, you know, you better figure out why you're miserable. If success, you know, if you thought success was going to bring you some form of happiness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's a lot of people, they don't understand that just because, you know, you're touring in a stadium playing band and you've got all this money and whatnot, and maybe that's not even the case. You're just, you know, you think that it's just great to be a rock star, but there's a lot of clearly unhappy people in the industry, because I mean, Linkin Park's Chester Bennington, you know, his suicide definitely stunned a lot of people. And Chris Cornell from Soundgarden and Audio Slave. And
it's Chris was a friend of ours. Yeah.
And it's just very depressing and sad to see these people that are, have true talent, and it's the least of their worries and concern is everything that comes with it. It's just, they're still not happy, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think people have a huge misconception of what it's like to really be in a band like Heart. I mean, you know, honestly, it's just a very alternate universe. It's not home, but it's just, it's very methodical. It's like, there's nothing that's like, you know, like you can forget about all the things you've seen in movies and all that. I mean, you know, it's like, nobody's standing on the top of a rooftop trying to jump into a pool saying they're a bronze god, like in, you know, in Cameron's Almost Famous. You know, it probably happened to Cameron, you know, I don't doubt it, you know, but, you know, really it's like, you know, you go to the lobby at like 2 o'clock, you know, a runner picks you up, you go to the venue, you do a quick sound check. You go look in catering, you go, oh, you know, I don't know if I can eat catering yet again, you know, because the food is questionable in some places. Some places it's known to be exceptional. And, you know, then you hang around, you know, you look on your computer, you know, you read, maybe you take a little walk. Then at like 10 o'clock, you play. And then you get on the bus, you go to sleep, you wake up and you're at a hotel and you just repeat the whole process. And there's nothing that there's very, very little that deviates from it. That's why after years and years and years of touring, it all just becomes this big mush of memories unless something dramatic happens, unless somebody falls off a stage or somebody gets on the stage or, you know, or something blows up on the stage. Or you know, or something dramatic happens that sets that gig apart, because everything else is just it is a routine, a series of Groundhog Day days.
Yeah,
that is what it feels like.
And I'm sure that just any job, you know, if someone was to ask me, you know, 3 weeks ago on that Wednesday, what did you do for work? I would have no idea, because I just, like, it was just a regular day for me, like nothing extraordinary happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like what you just said is like it makes a lot of sense. It's like, I think people can relate right now due to the fact of with the virus and everything. Like 2020 was kind of a non-year for a lot of people, and so in a way, touring is kind of like that, because you know, you get up, you know, you have your coffee, you have some breakfast, you maybe watch a little bit of news, you know, you find something to do, and then maybe you end up kind of going to bed early because you're bored, and then you start, you do the next day, you know. So there's a lot of people that were kind of forced into that situation last year. And I'm not saying that it's bad touring, but there is a parallel to what touring is like compared to that, because it is, you know, you may be playing at a different place every day, but the routine is never really changes.
Absolutely. Now, have you done any music videos with the band?
Yeah, we've done some. What was that? I think we did some videos on from the album Red Velvet Car and Fanatic, I think. I know we did some stuff from that, and obviously there's a ton of TV shows. I mean, I think we were on the Ellen Show twice. We were on Dancing with the Stars. We were on Conan O'Brien. I think we were on, let me think. Who am I thinking of? Who are some of the late night people I'm trying to think of? Oh, Jimmy Fallon. We were on Jimmy Kimmel twice. So the list goes on. We were on some crazy show on Showtime appearing as ourselves. You know, so there's a lot of that. And of course that's why there's a lot of DVDs that we put out, like we did. We played at the Royal Albert Hall with the London Philharmonic. I think that's available on DVD. And then we played at some big venue at Caesars in Canada. That was a DVD before that. And obviously the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so, there's no shortage of like when people, it's funny because people always, you know, they'll send me like a YouTube video and, you know, of us playing and me playing. And it's just like, they actually think that I want to watch me playing, you know. It's like the last thing I want to talk about is me and Heart. You know, as much as I love everybody, you know, to me, that's going to a workplace. And it's just like, well, I'd rather watch this video instead of like, you know, watching a video of, you know, us playing Straight On, you know, like at, you know, at the EMP Center, like in, you know, 2008.
Right, right.
You know, so... You know, I was there. I saw it. You know, I don't need to see it again. I had the best seat in the house.
Right. Now, with music videos that you've done, what was the experience like for you on set? Is it just pretty much just straightforward? Just they tell you what the theme's going to be like and whatnot, or?
Well, you know, that used to be that way. I mean, I've heard like, you know, like Ann and Nancy, and they've done a lot of interviews and how weird the videos got to be in the 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. like you know, like with the hair all crazy and wearing bustiers and being like, you know, being like, you know, on wires and being flying around with your guitar and, you know, and all that stuff, and I'm glad to see all that stuff go, because it's just like, it's like the music almost became secondary. Well, it did become secondary,
yeah,
when MTV first started. So the videos that we've done have all been basically, you know, you just go there and, you know, you fake it to the recording and, you know, you do it like, you know, you probably do it like 10 times and then it just gets edited down. And so it's more of like a video of a performance in that sense. And whatever they decide they want to edit in at that point, you know, so it's no different than like, and also like we did a bunch of videos like, you know, like Anne had a solo thing and she still does. It's like for in 2015, she did a thing called the Anne Wilson thing, which I was a big part of, which I really, really loved. It was like, we were kind of doing more blues oriented stuff. We were doing songs like I Put a Spell on You, mm-hmm. and kind of getting, it was like, it was a way for us to step away from Heart for a while and to say, you know, something, let's just play a bunch of songs we really love. And you know, we did like there, we did a, like a couple of PBS specials. So there is no shortage of music videos and professionally done things that we have done over the years. I mean, too many to count.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Now for live performances, what are some of the more favorite tours that you've done in the past with some of the bands that you've toured with?
Well, as I mentioned before, probably my favorite band of all time is Cheap Trick, just because they are like truly the nicest guys you ever want to meet, and we have a lot in common. I mean, like I have great stories I've spent a lot of time talking to Tom, the bass player, and Robin is the lead singer, is just one of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. And then of course, Rick, you know, the guitar player, Rick Nielsen, you know, he's known to, you know, like there's been times in the past where it's like, I just like watching them play. So oftentimes they would be on before us. So I would just go on, you know, on the side of the stage and watch them play. And it wasn't uncommon for Rick to see me on the side of the stage. And he would just like make a beeline, like in the middle of a song. And he'd go over and he'd start talking to me on the side of the stage. One time he actually took the guitar off his, you know, took it off his neck and put it on me in the middle of a Cheap Trick song in front of, like, you know, in front of 15,000 people, you know? So it's like, luckily I knew the song. So I'm sitting there playing it for like about 30 seconds. And then Rick takes the guitar off and he puts it back on him. And then he goes back on, you know. And I remember one time he saw me on the side of the stage and he's got, you know, his big shtick is he's got like all these guitar picks and he throws them out mm-hmm. to people. He saw me on the side of the stage one time many years ago. And I was kind of like giving him a hard time. And he walked over to me and he had literally a bucket full of guitar picks. And he took it and he poured the entire bucket of guitar picks all over my head. Like probably, you know, 5,000 guitar picks, you know, and it was just like, yeah, so those guys are great, and we've done a lot of stuff with Joan Jett, and once again, very, very just great people, you know. And like I said, I mean, you get to know these people. Like we did a tour of, we did like only three shows in New Zealand. We did a tour of New Zealand and only three shows, but we were there for like 12 days, and it was with Foreigner and Three Dog Night of all people. And, you know, we just had the three bands, we just had the most fun just hanging out because we had only three shows. And so we had, okay, you know, let's go into the city today, or let's go get Indian food. And it was, you know, so my memories of actually touring with a lot of people is really, really positive. I honestly can't think of one that wasn't. You know, and you know, and I probably wouldn't tell you who it was if I did, but like I said, it's like these people are just so friendly and so nice.
That's good too. That always makes everything a little bit more enjoyable and less stressful and whatnot. Now, yeah. speaking a little bit back on when you said, you know, things go pretty well for the most part, and it's most of the time it's just a typical, you know, just the regular routine of a day like any other job, you know. It's not what people make it out to be. What are some instances that were against that where it was like, man, that was a crazy experience, or like that was a crazy thing to witness?
Oh boy, okay. I'll give you a couple. I've told a few of these stories before, but I think probably a few of my, let me think. So there was one time early on, we were doing a tour of Europe and we were playing at one of those big festivals in Sweden. And I think Magic Man at that time was probably the song we started the show with, or at least the second song in. And we started playing Magic Man in like literally 30 seconds into the song, the neck of my guitar came off. It's just like my guitar kind of went out of tune and I'm looking at my guitar. It's like, what's going on? Then all of a sudden, literally, like it was a Pete Townsend moment, you know, like the neck just went ching and the strings are just hanging down. And it's like, you know, and we're looking at each other, and it's just like, sometimes, you know, with train wrecks on stage, you can recover and you can just go, okay. But that one, we literally had to stop the song. The guitar tech had to come over and, like, you know, get the guitar and give me another guitar. Then we just, you know, apologized and started the song over again, you know. And so, you know, those are the kind of things you remember. I remember one time we were playing, there is a bootleg video of this that a friend sent me one time, but this is probably going back to maybe 2007, 2005, something like that. We were playing at the Beacon Theater in New York City. And we're in the middle of this show, and our shows were pretty long at the time. I think they were close to like maybe a little over 2 hours long. And there is an older man who was All I can remember is he looked like the Mr. Clean guy from the commercials. He was bald-headed. He was large. He was a large man. He literally, like, the Beacon Theater is you know, your basic classic old, you know, like vaudeville cinema theater. So it's got a high stage, mm-hmm. and, you know, it used to be like, you know, for movies. And this guy just literally, he walks up, like, in the middle of a song, he walks up and he lifts himself up and gets onto the stage, and he starts to go towards Anne. And I see the crew, they just come in on this guy and literally they drag him off. And so I'm thinking, well, that's over. Thank God, you know, because that happens a lot. People get up on the stage, you know, and they'll step all over your equipment or whatever. And so I remember, like, towards, they escorted him outside. So I remember, like, about like 15 minutes before we ended the show, I'm looking out into the audience and I see this guy, he got back in.
Oh no.
And so, and I'm trying to tell the security, you know, the guy got back in. Mr. Clean, he's back in his seat. So sure enough, we're playing a really long, sort of involved song. I can't remember what it was, but I think it was called a song called Lost Angel. And I'll never forget, like, the guy stands up and I'm in playing and I'm just going, you know, he's got his pants half off, and he gets back, he tries to get back up on the stage again. He's got his shirt off and he's got his he's got his pants half off, and this time you see like this group of security people grab him, like, while he's getting onto the stage, and then literally drag him all the way down the aisle with his pants half off and you know, and it's so, you know, like, those kind of moments you remember. And then, like, another great example, which is one of my favorite stories, is there's a place called the Celebrity Theater. It's in Phoenix, and a lot of artists use that theater for shooting, like, live concerts, because it's a theater in the round that was built in the 60s, and it has a large circular stage that revolves. So you're constantly turning. But you're turning at such a pace that, you know, you can see the people in front of you, and then you know, when you look away, you turn your gaze, or somebody different in front of you. It's a very slow progression, but there's like four there's four aisles that go to the center stage. One is like one goes to offices, and one goes actually through a tunnel that goes back to the backstage area. Back in those days, speaking of the song Alone, the bass player, who was Mike Inez, great friend, wonderful guy, great bass player in Alice in Chains, was our bass player. And we, during that time, the drummer, the bass player, and I never played during the song Alone. It was just Nancy and the keyboard player, Deb Scher, who's a great keyboard player, another great friend. They played, so we went off the stage. So I got turned around and went down the aisle thinking I was going to go into the dressing room, and I went right into like a broom closet or something like that. I opened the door and it's just like, oh shit. So I'm just kind of waiting there for the song to end, you know, because I, you know, and then I just kind of open up the door and run back onto the stage, and, you know, so, the, you know, it's those kind of things where we're, you know, and amps have blown up, and we've been handed guitars that were completely in the wrong tuning. Oh, and there's been a few times where, you know, everything that Heart has ever done has always been live. So we like the experience of not having like Pro Tools or something running in the background. So if there's a mistake, it's an honest mistake, you know, and we look at it like, well, you know, we're human, and it's kind of cool, because if you know, we're not going to make the same mistake tomorrow night. So these people actually got to see something that's unique.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's like, well, okay, you know, so, you know, we forgot the lyrics, or, you know, we left out a guitar solo by accident, or this happened, or the amp blew up, or something like that. You know, we've been we've been rained on, we've been snowed on, we've been, you know, it's like, you know, we've played on the worst rickety stages you can possibly imagine, and you know, under every type of condition.
Now, in your very successful career, what are some conflicts or failures that you have come across, and what did you do to overcome those?
Well, I think the music business in general is a series of conflicts, you know, and you probably have more failures than you have successes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I said, when I started playing guitar, I started early on focusing on being, like I really wanted to be a songwriter, you know, artist, producer, and in our 20s, I got like a, I had a great partner, Harlan Lansky, that we did music together. You know, he did more of the business side. I did more of the music side, but he was also quite talented at the music aspect, you know, and we were probably in our mid 20s and, you know, and we got a deal on MCA Records, which was a pretty big thing. You know, and we did an album and it was starting to make some noise. And then instantly, without warning, like the record, the head of the label got fired. And another very prominent person who you would probably know of took over the label and he cleaned house. So we went from having a song on the charts and starting to have success. We had a great, you know, great review in Billboard, and the next day it was over. Literally, you know, you spend 2 years working on something and then overnight it's over. And, you know, so that story is so common. You know, it's not uncommon for that to happen. I mean, you think about all the people that make records, or remember back in the days, I mean, you're obviously too young to remember this, but, you know, back in the days when you'd go to a record store, you know, you could just go through this and it's like, who's this person? Who's that person? Oh, I know who this person is, you know? And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people, and those are the people that actually got to make records. Think of all the people that got record deals and made records that never came out. Mm-hmm. I mean, the percentage of people that actually, you know, to get a record deal, is like, you know, like the percentage is small. Then to actually make a record, this percentage even gets even smaller. And then to actually get a record that gets put out is even smaller than that. Then obviously to have it be successful is like, you know, it's like the 1 or 2% of the 100% of records. You know, so the thing is, you know, under that circumstance, I made a decision, a conscious decision, that me as a quote performer, that I was going to just focus on being in the studio and having a production company, because it didn't make sense to me to be an artist and put yourself through that. I wasn't going to go through the process of doing that again. So I said, well, I'm going to take, obviously I've got a strength when it comes to songwriting and being in the studio and putting things together. So I said, I'm just going to have a company that develops artists and gets record deals for them, and they're going to be my songs. So that way, if two or three of the deals disappear, I still got seven more. Mm-hmm. You know. So and it's unfortunate, because I have friends and I know some people who have never gotten over that. They got their one big chance, and it went south, and they could never get past that. They could never just say, I'm going to morph into something else. You know, it's like the bitterness of this happened to me, and, you know, and it's not fair, and blah, 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 and all this. And it's like, as opposed to just picking yourself up and just saying, well, okay, I learned something. Now, what else can I focus on?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Now, with the like we said, the last year with everything just kind of being shut out for everybody, what's the band been up to?
Well, the band hasn't been up to anything. You know, Heart as a band, I mean, there was no live performances in 2020 at all. I mean, Ann did, she did a guest appearance live with another band. She sang like a couple of songs, but there hasn't been any Heart stuff or any Ann Wilson or Nancy Wilson stuff. There's been some, I know Nancy's been working on a live album. I mean, she's been working on a solo album, and Ann has put out some solo stuff, some of the stuff that I had co-written with her, and some of the things that she'd co-written with another band member. So, you know, the keeping active, but, you know, it's 2020 has been a non-year for musicians. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know how and if it's ever going to recover. I mean, I can't imagine these large venues like Live Nation and all the places we played in 2019, you know, with the Heart Tour with Joan Jett and Sheryl Crow, and you know, it was an amazing tour, but you know, I can't imagine how these venues could possibly, you know, can exist for a year and a half with no revenue.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like how the vendors and how all these people, it's like everybody's just kind of shell-shocked in the entertainment business, and there's really nothing we can do about it. I mean, I guess the one saving grace is we're all kind of in this together, and we all can commiserate about how it's been. But I mean, you know, it's like, I think I saw on Facebook, somebody said like something to the effect of, you think it's tough losing your job, try losing your career. And, you know, and that's kind of what it felt like. I mean, for years, I've really enjoyed mentoring and helping people and instructing people. So it gave me the opportunity to sort of shift gears in 2020 and start to, teach, songwriting and music production and guitar techniques and how to use Logic and Pro Tools, and basically, you know, how to help people become more musical. Mm-hmm. And so that I started a company. It really became a really great thing for me, because I feel like I'm giving back to people. It's, you know, the website, if anybody wants to check it out, it's called yourmusicality.com, all one word, yourmusicality.com. And, you know, and it really makes me feel nice just to have, you know, to have people say, well, you know, I always wanted to write a song, and I've written poetry, but I never knew how to put two and two together. And I've been doing that since I was a kid. So, well, here, let me show you how to do it, you know, and to have that feeling of letting people being able to express themselves is been a very gratifying one for me. And so that's how I've been spent 2020 and the first part of 2021. And it's really, really doing quite well. And I'm really enjoying it. So I'm not touring. I'm not like getting out of a tour bus, and I'm not finding my way into catering and getting lost, finding the stage like Spinal Tap, you know, but, yeah. You know, but I feel like I'm doing something that's rewarding and giving back.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any word of any possible or potential upcoming shows or tours this year?
I don't think anybody does. You know, everything is so up in the air. I mean, we're subject to the same, you know, curiosity that you see on the news. It's like, well, you know, when's this going to end? Well, yeah, you know, it can end in a couple of months, but there's this variant, and then you get the, you know, you get the anti-vaxxers. How are they going to affect, you know, how are they going to affect the situation when you're packed in with 15,000 people?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
so the logistics of getting a concert size, like, you know, venue, show, tour together, it just, you know, it takes months to plan something like that. So until there's a green light and people can really see a light at the end of the tunnel, and I think we're seeing that now with the vaccines and this Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's coming out, I think that it's going to get to the point. But I think it's not going to happen until, say, this Johnson & Johnson vaccine comes out and they start to be able to focus on, you know, right now it's 65 and older, used to be 75 and older. Now when they start to, you know, the vaccine like Johnson & Johnson becomes so available that millennials, mm-hmm. 30s, and they can just get the shot and just say, well, okay, now, you know, maybe I'm not going to get sick, but at least when I go see mom and dad or I go to a concert, I know that I'm not going to get the person next to me sick.
Exactly.
You know, at that point, I think everything's really, really going to open up, because it's one thing to say, okay, now we've got the people who are most susceptible, people who are, you know, at a certain age group, you know, we've got them vaccinated, you know, and so that really brings down the mortality rate. But until we start to see everybody of every age group start to really want to get vaccinated, then that's when things are going to open up. And who knows when that's going to happen.
I agree more with you. Yeah, there's a lot of people out there that are totally against it. And myself, I'm not really all about getting it just quite yet, because it's just so fresh and new. I'm in the boat of, I want to see how well it really does a positive thing, and then I'll consider it. But at this point, you know, I just want to see how it's going to work out as a standpoint and make sure that it's not going to, you know, make me grow an arm out of my back or whatnot.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, Craig, I appreciate you taking this time to talk with me today with this interview. Before we wrap it up, I just want to say thank you again. And I remember checking out Heart way before, I think way before any of my other siblings. I was about 12 when I first heard Magic Man, and then I started digging into it and, you know, got into Barracuda and all that good stuff. So
it's a lot of music.
Yeah, it was a good catalog that I got to check out before, you know, I ran out.
Yeah, good deal.
Now, is there anything you want to say to anybody listening before we were cut out?
No, well, you know, just everybody stay safe, you know, stay safe. I mean, if they've got, like, you know, like you, you know, if you're on the fence about the vaccine, just, you know, be smart and stay safe.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that's all. I mean, you know, think of other people, you know, as well as yourself. And that's just a good motto in life, even if we didn't have COVID.
Yeah, definitely. And my last question for you, I asked this for Albert Bouchard, who is in Blue Oyster Cult. Mm-hmm. I asked him, would you rather own a horse-sized dog or a cat-sized mouse? And what would you name it?
Oh, well, you know, I'm a huge animal lover. I've rescued a lot of animals over the years, and I currently have two cats. So I would definitely go with the little cat.
Yeah,
as long as my two cats currently didn't think that it was a toy to play with. And let's see, how about scraps?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, again, I thank you so much for this, Craig.
It's my pleasure, and like I said, stay safe and you take care.
Thank you. You as well.